and welcome to another episode of the Hope Mindful Compassion Show. My name's Paul Garrigan. I'm the mindfulness coach here at Hope Rehab.
My name's Simon Mott. I'm the treatment director here at Hope Rehab.
So Simon, one of the things that I've heard clients talk about since I came here, and I'd never really heard it much before, was this thing about king baby. What is a king baby?
That's a good question. I mean, in terms, in relation to addiction treatment, king baby is quite a well-known concept that was brought to us by a chap called Tom Cunningham from Hazelden. It's a bit dated, and of course, with the expansion of therapeutic interventions these days, there's so many choices and so many sophisticated options. But king baby, it harks back, and it's got quite kind of a basic concept, although it's got a great pedigree, you could say. But it's a way to relate to our addictions, really.
In what way?
Well, in what way? Because I think most addicts will tell you or will identify that the selfish and self-centered nature of addiction sort of is reminiscent of being a baby, you know. So in that way.
But would some people not find that kind of offensive, calling a big baby?
I really like the fact you've asked me that, because it just reminds me of when I was introduced to this about 20 years ago in a rehab. One day, my counsellor walked up to me. He gave me a pamphlet. He said, "Read this. This is you." And I was offended. How dare he? You know, I thought I was doing really well, very helpful around the place, and you know, he's calling me a baby. But of course, as I read it, I couldn't help but, relate to some of what was in this pamphlet. Character traits and personality traits, you could say.
So what are they? What are the character traits of a big baby?
Well, of course, starting off with self-centeredness. It kind of expands on that, and it kind of looks at a sort of a broad view of life, how we relate to authority figures. You know, if someone tells us what to do, how often, I can speak for myself, I don't like it, you know, and immediately my defences come up. Or another character trait would be sort of greed, you could say greed, you know, I certainly can relate to that throughout my childhood, having a taste for sweets, and I used to even steal money from my mother's purse to get sweets. So it breaks it down into examples of how it, how it manifests, you could say.
So can you give an example? Like, so you've sort of seen so many clients over the years. Is that, obviously without mentioning any names or being too specific, of a sort of, you know, somebody who really exhibited these sort of big baby traits?
Well, yeah, I mean, I can think of someone who's here now. When we do the exercise, we read out some of the examples, and people put up their hands, and everyone puts up their hands. But like, for example, anger, rage, not just anger, but rage, you know. Going back to, I said a pedigree, it has a pedigree. It actually originates from a Freudian concept. Narcissism.
Okay. So,
as you know, Freud used a lot of the Greek classic tales, you know, from Greek mythology and so on, as metaphors for some of his concepts. And he used, the story of Narcissus and Echo. And the idea where Narcissus is, you know, so self-obsessed, he's looking, you know, at a reflection of himself, but, you know, he can't draw himself away, and he ends up withering and dying, you know, because he's so obsessed with himself. He forgets to meet his daily, he forgets to, you know, look after himself, his basic needs, you know. And I think that's true of addicts and alcoholics, you know. They're so obsessed with fulfilling the need to use, that basic needs go out the window, and of course, you know, we get ill.
So basically it starts then off as like a coping strategy, would you say?
I agree, you know, that from my experience and all the people I've worked with, most of us, including myself, you know, we use our addictions were a means to cope with either ourselves a self-management system, or with life, you know, being maybe ill-equipped or of that disposition, like I said, anger, reactionary, self-piteous. You know, most of us sort of resorted to drugs and alcohol as an antidepressant, anti-anxiety, as a way to feel good about ourselves, get a quick high. So, yes, Narcissus, you're right, narcissistic personality disorder, although it's highly destructive and a negative thing in adulthood, as children.
That's what you want to say. Yeah. I mean, so could it be something that actually works as a child, kind of, but it's just not suitable for when you're an adult?
Possibly, but I mean, basically the way I view it is that it develops as a child for a reason. So some theorists say it develops because our needs weren't met. So we overcompensate, you know, we're kind of insecure about meeting our needs, and then that follows us into adulthood, and we're obsessed with meeting our own needs. And of course, it's not conducive to a happy life, you know, because we need to work together with people and have meaningful, constructive relationships.
So really, then the drug abuse or alcohol abuse maybe just be a kind of a symptom of that, or one aspect of it, and that just sort of stopping this substance abuse might not be enough to actually.
Right, that's another poignant sort of question, but basically the way that AA, or the Minnesota method, I should say, have used this concept is to highlight that just with taking the substances away still leaves us with these personality traits if we don't work on them. So that's the idea. So they also have another term, dry drunk syndrome.
Right.
So the idea that just giving up drugs and alcohol will still leave you relatively unhappy and unfulfilled, because we need to work on not necessarily underlying, you could call it underlying issues like therapists work on, but we need to work on some of those sort of more superficial character traits and personality traits so we can get on in our lives and so we won't fall back and relapse.
Right. So say like I'm a client coming to you, Simon, and I'm sort of saying I've heard about this this big baby syndrome. How would I know if I actually had it? Like, what sort of symptoms would I? You have like a little checklist.
We do. We have a checklist. So I've worked quite extensively on this concept. I tried to bring it sort of updated a little bit, you know, not to say it wasn't great when it was introduced. So it was introduced, King Baby Syndrome, with some character traits and examples. But the last part of it was about personas. So the idea is you go through a list of personas and you identify which ones suit you, you know, apply to you. So, you know, it could be a controlling personality type. It could be a perfectionist personality type. It could be, you know, the joker, the clown to get attention, or, you know, there's various, you know, personality types. So we use these concepts in our treatment. And you know what, those group exercises are really popular because they really bring the group together. They're a great leveler. It's you know, when you've got a whole group and you ask them, you know, do you see the world as a jungle full of selfish people, or do you find it hard to take on criticism, and people will own that, it really brings people together. You know, that they're able to own that and say, yes, yeah, I relate to that, and it's irrational. Or, and then likewise, we do the personas week, where we do take everyone gets a chance to sit in the hot seat and, you know, bring it on. Basically, everyone gives them feedback what personas they think they have. And the idea is the sort of more Jungian idea, perhaps, that the under that persona is the vulnerable, hurt child, perhaps, or human being that uses personas to survive, like we used the drugs and alcohol.
And would you say it's possible or likely for someone to be caught up in addiction and not have some of this stuff?
I do. It's an interesting point you make, because of course when you read lots or come across lots of ideas out there, you know, I've seen people write every addict has a personality disorder, every addict, needs the 12 steps to recover. Every act. So these sort of black and white broad statements. No, there's always exceptions. And, you know, we get people coming here who had very, very idyllic childhoods and who seem quite balanced, pleasant human beings without the negative character traits, and they still have addictions. So, no, it's, you know, some more than others.
Have you noticed any sort of the difference between different types of substance abuse, that say certain types of substance abuse would tie in with certain types of this big baby syndrome?
Well, I'm not sure about that. But yes, you could say, let's say we take anger, for example. So someone did some research and wrote a really interesting piece on the idea that we're all attracted to a particular, our own drug of choice, right? And that's because each drug of choice, stimulants, alcohol, heroin, opiates, do something different in our brains, right? And so a bit like the ADHD theory, where they medicate ADHD with stimulants because it rebalances the brain. Now, I'm not 100% sold on all that, but that theory is interesting. So you apply that theory to different substances and different people. So, for example, I used, my drug of choice was opiates, right? And opiates seemed to calm me down. They calmed my brain. I was very angry, you know, king baby, basically. Yeah. And it seemed to level me out a bit. So I do like that theory that we're each, there's no accidents why we're attracted to that particular substance. It seemed to, like alcoholics, you know, often it's, it helps with anxiety, for example.
So it kind of sort of emphasises, because I know you sort of, this is important to you as a manager of Hope, to sort of really take people's drug of choice into account when sort of treating them, and not just provide sort of a one-size-fits-all sort of thing.
Mm. Well, that's true. I mean, for a number of reasons. One is to keep the place safe, you know, because you know, there's, you know, there's the functioning alcoholics, there's the, you know, heroin addicts, let's say, who really lost all their values, and they're harder to keep contained. So we do have to look at people, and we have to ask ourselves, you know, how appropriately to treat this person. What I would say is that after a month of treatment, it seems to level out and everyone's just the same human being. Once the substances have been taken away and that they've all gotten on board, really, to the program. But you can see differences in people according to the substance that they abuse. You can. It has to be said.
I must imagine this. Some of this comes to a big shock to people, because I know it did for me, because for a long time I thought my problem was alcohol, and it was only when I actually gave up alcohol that I realised how many problems I actually had.
Yes, quite. I mean, it's the same for all of us, really. I mean, you know, everyone finds that out. Some people are more open about that and seem to be more conducive, you know, in terms of looking at themselves and then accepting that there's a deeper problem, let's say, or that's caused the substance abuse. And other people get here and they say, no, I just want to stop that and I'm okay. Don't really want to change much in my life.
And what's the danger with that?
With
just sort of stopping the substance abuse and not wanting to go anywhere near this sort of personality
stuff. Well, there are dangers. You know, some people can get away with it for a while. But inevitably, if you don't open up sort of your life and take a careful look at it, who you are, you know, where you live, where you're going, what you do, that there's so many pitfalls and triggers that will take people back. It can't be avoided. That's where the brain disease theory comes in. You know, that our brains are now sort of shaped, you know, according to who we are in our environment, and we can easily use again if we don't make some changes. So in order to make changes, we need to have a careful look, and that's inside and out.
So what advice would you sort of give to somebody sort of saying, okay, you know, this stuff is like a problem for me. How do I actually sort it? I mean, what is the process for dealing with this stuff? I mean, is it something that can be done fast, or is it going to take a lifetime to...
Well, I mean, initially, coming to rehab is a huge step. So when someone gets here, then they're definitely got a good chance, you know. But what they do here makes a difference. So there's a number of factors, aren't there? I say getting a really healthy routine together is just as important as looking at your deeper issues. But I think ultimately it's being open to change. You know, if you're open to saying, listen, I need to change, there's things I need to change about myself, that's going to hold you in good stead, give you a good chance of recovery. And, of course, King Baby really opens that up, that can of worms up. So that's why it's a really exciting, powerful group to get people to take part in, because they can really see I am the problem, or I've got problems and I need to sort these, or I probably won't stay sober, you know.
And do you ever, you know, do you ever sort of get to that point where, you know, it's so obvious to you know, even to that person that this is the problem, and they just say, no, I just don't want to deal with this.
Well, we do. And
what can you do about that?
Well, that's, we have the motivational interviewing technique, you know, sort of trying to roll with the resistance or highlight discrepancies and say, okay, well, you say everything's fine. You know,
because I would imagine the inability to handle criticism might actually be a part of this, would it be?
It would. I think you're right. That's the whole idea of, you know, a safe environment, a safe community that makes it slightly easier. And of course, if you've had a childhood where criticism or doing something wrong led to you getting a good hiding, let's say, then you're not going to want to own that. So there's good reason why people are resistant when they are resistant, but it's our job then to make them feel so safe that they're willing to give it a go.
And so, and obviously, you know, once these sort of coping strategies are gone, they will need better coping strategies.
Well, yeah, I suppose you're right. Yeah, you know, when you take away the drugs and alcohol, it's a way to numb the pain.
And even the anger, isn't it? I mean, you can sort of see the anger as a coping strategy.
Absolutely. I mean, I have it myself, and I was always aware it's a bit of an addiction with me. You know, it's an auto-reaction. And, of course, it was something I needed to work on. And I still do, to be honest with you, you know.
Because I've had this conversation even with clients, and they've sort of said, well, if I stop being angry, people will just walk all over me.
That's a good point. So that's like a core belief, you know. That's where the CBT comes in. And then we say, okay, well, then where's the evidence for that? And then we ask them to sort of explore disputing that as a core belief. And then maybe, you know, coming up with some new affirmations. Anger, you know, we would say just replace it with being assertive, for example, and tolerant. So, yeah.
That's really interesting, Simon. We went well over our time. That was really good.
Yes.
I know you're really busy, so thanks for finding time for us.
No, that's good. I enjoyed it.
Okay.